From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes, in for Larry Mantle. Democratic presidential candidates kick off their schedule of primary debates. 20 candidates split into two debates on two separate nights. But which of them will get to put direct pressure on frontrunners like Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders? Kamala Harris will. A California poll out this week, though, has bad news for her. We will discuss it all in our weekly politics segment on Air Talk, right after the news. Good morning. It's Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Kyle Stokes, in for Larry Mantle, who is off all of this week, and I get to sit in his chair and have a conversation with you folks about what's going on here in Southern California. Hope you all had great weekends. I bet Laker fans had especially good weekends after this weekend's big trade for Anthony Davis and after the team missed the playoffs for the last six seasons. Many people now see the Lakers as immediate title contenders. We are going to discuss this big trade coming up in our next hour, that coming up at 11 here on Air Talk. But first, we want to start Monday morning, as we always do, with our weekly revisiting of the week that was in politics. And joining us to do that is Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, a lecturer in political science and director of civic engagement at the University of Texas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Howdy from Austin.
Howdy. Hook 'em. And also on the line with us is Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst and partner at Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco, former advisor to California Governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and a former White House staffer for Presidents Reagan and H.W. Bush. Hook 'em to you as well.
Hook 'em.
It's what they say at the University of Texas, just in case anybody's missing out on this joke in the audience. I don't know if Sean Walsh has a college thing that you say at where you went to college.
Well, I'm a UCLA land-grant man myself, although I'm shocked that the Texas professor says howdy, which is a classic A&M greeting, not a UT greeting.
But I'm just saying. Them's fighting words.
Throw down.
You professor. Know, we don't need to compete on the A&M front because the clear winner – is right here in Austin, Texas. But I'm going to leave it at that because I know your SoCal listeners are not interested in that.
I'm very into the SEC fight. So you know, I know that, you know, I've bridged both sides of the Big 12 SEC fight. Anyway, let's get to politics here. So late last week, the Democratic National Committee and NBC News unveiled the lineups for two televised presidential primary debates coming up next week in Miami. The top 20 candidates qualified. They are being split over two nights. And I think it's fair to say the Democratic National Committee had hoped to avoid the appearance that they'd hold one debate with the front runners, followed by the quote unquote kids table candidates debate. And that is arguably not the result that they got, although we can discuss that. But let's go through the lineups. Night one is next Wednesday, the 26th. Elizabeth Warren headlines that group of 10. Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke will also be featured on that night one debate, but their poll averages have been quite low. Now, the following night, Thursday, the 27th, the much more higher polling candidates will debate. Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, and Joe Biden, the candidate who is leading in most polls. We want to hear your thoughts, Air Talk listeners. What are you hoping to hear from the candidates, especially with such a large field? And in fact, how are you kind of piecing through this large field? Also, the fact that there are 20 candidates that are going to be on the debate stage over two nights. How do you think that the DNC handled this large field? And is it confusing or is it great that we're having such a wide and broad conversation with so many different types of candidates? You can give us a call at 866-893-KPCC. Again, that's 866-893-5722. Or you can leave a comment as well on the Air Talk page. Let's get to our panel here. Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, tell me, why are these debates meaningful? And to whom do these debates mean the most?
Well, first of all, Kyle, you can call me Vicky because I have a very long name.
first reference, that, Ms. Soto.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Vicky. Vicky is fine. You know, I think these debates are an opening salvo for the 2020 political season. So I think this is going to be of interest, obviously, to Democrats and independents, but I think also to Republicans to start to get a sense of what the field is going to look like as we get into the 2020 election. election. I can't tell you we're going to see a lot of meat when it comes to policy because you have only 2 hours and you have 10 candidates each night. And by my latest count, there are 4 moderators for each of the 2 debates. So we're not going to get into anything meaty, but I think that what we're going to be looking for are some zingers. We're also going to be wanting to see who looks presidential, who is going to be able to carry on into the 2020 general. I think that for me is the appetizer of this course. And as we winnow the field, we know that the debates are going to be getting smaller as we go through the next couple of months. Then we're going to start to do a deep dive into policy. But for right now, it's that first flash of how people stack up.
Yeah, the beginning of that winnowing process. Sean T. Walsh, this was about the period in the campaign in 2016 where Donald Trump was not polling anywhere near a frontrunner status, but where the climb began. I'm wondering if you can sort of weigh in. Why are these debates meaningful and to whom these debates mean the most?
Well, they're meaningful insofar as the entire country, if they so choose, can actually watch everybody all together and see how they interact. And this is actually particularly meaningful for the also-rans, I would say right now, the folks that are polling at 0.3% or, you know, 2 or 3%. They have a chance to actually move up in the polls and hold themselves into a pretty decent position. I think the potential big losers here always are if you're the front runner and you stumble badly, like a Joe Biden, you have a lot to lose and not that much to gain because you're already the front runner. So, again, the little guys have a chance and gals have a chance to move up, and the big guys have a chance and gals to hurt themselves badly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I want to go through some of the candidates, and you mentioned sort of the also-rans, Sean, as well as some of the bigger names. I'm thinking about right now Elizabeth Warren, who was, you know, sort of, you know, seemed to be one of the biggest losers in this debate lineup because she was not put on the same stage as Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden. I'm wondering if you can both weigh in on her. Vicky, let's start with you. I'm wondering if you're Elizabeth Warren, do you feel a little bit like you missed an opportunity to take direct aim at the front runners here?
I may be the exception here, but I don't necessarily see a pro or con for one particular night because, you know, on the one hand, Elizabeth Warren isn't up against Joe Biden, but on the other hand, she has her own opportunity to shine. And then in having the other folks in the first night coming at her, it makes her stand out like a front runner even more. And we could go on and saying, but what about this? And what about if this happens? I don't think there's one definitive marker of this is a bad case to be on the first night or a bad case to be on the second night. It's what you make of it. Everybody wants to be up against the front runner, but at the same time, everybody wants their own time to shine. So I think you're going to just have to make of it what you get.
Yeah. Sean, I'm wondering if you can weigh in here. Does it really matter that Elizabeth Warren isn't going to be sharing the stage with the quote unquote biggest names on the debate stage next week?
Yeah, I have a little bit of a different take than the professor. I actually think this is a great advantage to the extent that there are advantages in these for her to pretty much have the stage to herself as a major named candidate. So the lesser named candidates are going to have to take pot shots at her. And honestly, she will basically be the center of the vortex in that debate. If you're a little candidate, lesser known candidate, you're going to want to try and make your mark, and you make your mark mostly by going after the top dog. And in this case, it'll be Warren. So, again, I think it plays to her advantage. And the second thing is where I think it plays well to her. Her campaign about 2 months ago was in pretty bad shape. It wasn't raising money. They had staff problems. Right. Their fundraiser left. And she's actually been surging in the polls. And she's surging in the polls because she is a very articulate, very thoughtful, very analytical person. She's a college professor. And if you're a good college professor, like my co-host here, your students like you and you're able to explain complex things in fairly simple and easily digestible things. So I think she could be the big winner here.
Yeah. Now, one of the direct comparisons that's made between Elizabeth Warren is to Bernie Sanders, actually, who is polling much better right now in terms of the average of overall national polls. But there have been some observers who've wondered if his campaign campaign is drifting a little bit, not really gaining a lot of ground on Joe Biden. There have been a lot of direct comparisons between him and Warren. And because there is, as you point out, Sean, that kind of energy behind Warren's campaign, maybe if Bernie Sanders, I'll start with you in responding to this question, because you said earlier, well, the most important thing for Bernie Sanders is don't screw up and fall on your face. On the other hand, maybe Bernie Sanders does have something to prove in a debate like this, Sean.
Well, I'm not sure Sanders has to worry about screwing up and falling on his face, just kind of his style. He's going to play to an activist base of the Democratic Party. And the interesting part is that I think Sanders right now and Warren are competing for the same basic core vote in the Democratic Party. The person I think really has to worry about screwing up and falling on his face is Joe Biden. So, having an Elizabeth Warren in this race in the Democratic primary is a real and clear danger to Bernie Sanders' campaign. And she is much more, in my view, Bernie comes off in a little bit of a haphazard. His hair is askew in 15 different directions. He kind of goes off on these tangents the way his speaking style is. And I think Elizabeth Warren is, again, much more clear and much more precise. So, as I say, if I were going to compare the two, I think that it's actually an advantage both to Sanders and to Warren not to be on the same stage at the same time, because, again, you're competing for each other's votes. So let's see if Sanders can hurt Joe Biden, and let's see if Warren can just capitalize on the being the supreme person coming out of the first debate.
Right. Vicky, what about Bernie Sanders here? I mean, he's been sort of in the middle of this reset, coming out with a big policy speech on how he sees democratic socialism in recent weeks here. Is he in need of a reset moment, a sort of redefinition moment, or is it about playing good fundamentals, just having a clean debate here?
So the other thing I want to shine a spotlight on with regards to Bernie Sanders is the difference between his 2016 campaign, where he had some trouble with voters of color.
Right.
And in this campaign, we have seen a very deliberative effort at targeting African-American constituencies, Latino constituencies, youth constituencies within those communities of color, and having a good base there. So I think that is an important fundamental that they have built on, excluding whether they need to reset and refresh. I think that's a core fundamental that he has built in. But in talking about the second night, yes, it's the Bernie and Biden show. But we can't forget that Pete Buttigieg and Kamala are also going to be on that stage. So I'm almost more interested in seeing Mayor Pete and Kamala and how they interact and how they elbow in for room on that night, because they are that younger face, that more diverse face, whether in terms of sexual preference or ethnic racial background. So for me, I think that is the storyline to keep watching, aside from Bernie and Biden duking it out.
Yeah, and those are two very strong polling candidates, Sean, as well, that are sort of poised in that position where they could take off after this debate if they're able to put on a good show.
Perhaps. I think the professor brings up an interesting point. So this current field, I mean, last time you had Hillary Clinton and you had Bernie Sanders, so there wasn't a lot of ethnic diversity or racial diversity. You had, okay, gender diversity there. This time out, you've got Booker, you've got Klobuchar, you've got Gillibrand. I mean, it's really a potpourri of ethnic, racial, and gender diversity, and even LGBT diversity. So, I mean, there's a lot to choose from in this group. It's interesting to see the Democratic Party tends to be a little bit more fractured. I mean, they even apportion delegates based on racial, makeup. So it's interesting to see what happens in that regard. Senator Harris, I think, being a woman and of a mixed race background, should be attractive for that particular issue. But as I think you noted on your intro, she's having a little bit of trouble even in California. So I'm not sure she's catching fire in that group. And it'll be interesting to see how a fractured Democratic party with regards to all of those issues actually coalesces behind any of these candidates after the debates.
Julie H. writes on the Air Talk page, good for Elizabeth Warren that she's debating on the first night. By the next night, plenty of people will be debated out and may not tune in to the other night's debates. Mm-hmm. We're going to be back with after a short break for with our weekly look at politics with our panelists Sean T. Walsh and Vicky DeFrancesco Soto. Back in a moment here on Air Talk with a look at our weekly roundup of politics. You're listening to Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Kyle Stokes in all this week for Larry Mantle, and we are going through the week that was in politics with our panelists Vicky DeFrancesco Soto from the University of Texas and Sean T. Walsh, a Republican political analyst and a partner at Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco. And we're talking about the lineups in the Democratic presidential debates that are coming up next week. And we want to hear your thoughts on the debate field. These are 20 candidates who qualified over two different nights of debating, with Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders on the second night and Elizabeth Warren headlining the first night of debates. We want to hear your thoughts. Is this a good way to be conducting these debates over two different nights, or has this field become too manageable? Is the format going to become confusing for voters? We want to hear your thoughts at 866-893-KPCC. Again, that's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org/airtalk, where Joaquin in South L.A. asks a really salient question that I'd like to put to our panel here, and that's, is any casual voter going to watch? I can think of nothing more boring than 20 candidates ignoring every question to deliver their 90-second elevator pitch. Sean, given the format, given how many people, even if it's just 10 people on the stage, how are we going to get meaningful answers out of these candidates to the point that people are going to want to continue watching?
Well, again, this is, I do think people will watch, and I particularly think people will watch from the Democratic side. This is the first kind of beauty contest where you're going to actually see all of them together and you can size them up. So I hate to use probably a bad analogy, but it's like going onto a car lot when you have all the new models out for the year. You go and you may not be doing a test drive or buy, but you're looking at all the new models like at an auto show. So I do think people will pay attention. And the issue is, can someone stand out even with a good one-liner? And I think people can. The last election on the Republican side, what do we have, 16 people? It was just a mess. But it allowed Donald Trump, kind of a no-name that no one took seriously, to move up based on his debate styles. And the guy that was I backed, Jeb Bush, ended up doing very poorly in those debates, and he ended up getting smoked. So you'll be surprised that these debates will take some front runners who are very bright and could be very good leaders, and it will knock them out. And people who you never even thought about will look very good and move up. I do think that Mayor Pete has a lot to gain from these debates. I think Senator Harris potentially does. I don't think she's branded herself very well nationally. So I think you can see some folks that are kind of in the middle of the pack rise up.
Yeah. So, Vicky, to Sean's point, do you agree with Sean that the debates could have a potential impact, even with a very limited format here?
I do. And to your point from Joaquin, who wrote in, I think there's a direct and an indirect impact. You know, political junkies like myself and Sean and you, Kyle, we're going to be watching. We're going to be glued to the TV watching this. But most folks really aren't. They've got other stuff going on. But they will be hearing about the debates through social media, through conversations with friends, colleagues at work, hearing about it on news shorts as they're driving to work or on podcasts. So I think maybe that traditional notion of, you know, 1950s, 1960s, everybody sits around the TV and watches one thing is long gone. A core of us will be doing that. But the commentary that spins off of that, I think, is what is going to be so crucial here for this first take.
MKLA on the AirTalk page writes, this is a huge opportunity for those below the top six who get most of the media gas. There are gems there from the small states with less name recognition. opposition, i.e. Amy Klobuchar. She may well rise in the debate, poised and experienced on policy and politics. As a Minnesotan, I resent the decision that Minnesota is a small state, but I accept that it is smaller than California, that's for sure. But Sean, you were also mentioning this could be a big deal for some of the, you know, we were talking about them as the also-ran candidates. If you are an Amy Klobuchar, you know, this could be an opportunity for you to take fire, or are you looking essentially, if you're maybe running for a cabinet post or something like that, and that's why you're in the race, maybe this is a different sort of opportunity with these debates?
Well, so let's remember, we're in a primary, not a general election. And in a primary, everybody doesn't vote. Generally, you're more activist, you're more motivated voters end up coming out and voting. And in this case, the Democrats from the left side of the party going center left to mostly far left, the more left you are, the more activist they seem to be. So you're appealing to those folks, number one. Number two, you're also doing math. And the math is, who do you appeal to in Iowa and who do you appeal to in New Hampshire? Because those are the two first states and, you know, people live and die. If they don't do well in those states, they're smoked and they're gone within a week before you get to New Hampshire. And then right after that, you've got South Carolina, you've got Nevada, and then you've got California. So really, you're doing a certain kind of math and a certain kind of cleavage, and you're appealing to a certain kind of voter just to keep yourself alive. So there's a lot of strategy, I think, that's going to be put into place here with regards to going after specific voters in specific states. And you're a winner if you can actually appeal to those voters.
Right. And Amy Klobuchar, for instance, has been noted and dinged for the fact that she isn't polling so well in Iowa, despite that being a central part of her pitch, that she's not going to ignore the Midwest like, you know, people had argued or criticized Hillary Clinton's campaign for doing, and also making a play in Iowa, that as a neighboring state senator, maybe she would resonate better in Iowa. Vicky, you know, if you are a Jay Inslee or an Amy Klobuchar, what are you looking for out of this debate? And is it, as Sean says, to kind of make your mark ahead for Iowa and New Hampshire?
You're trying to make your mark in the short term for the primary, because that's what's coming up first. But I also think that if you're looking at the numbers, you figure that your shot of actually making it out of the primary is pretty slim. So I think what we're also going to be seeing here are candidates trying to position themselves for strong team members for the general election for the Democratic nominee. And also, if that Democratic nominee were to win, to be someone to be recruited on to that transition team to the new Democratic administration. So I think there are multiple considerations for these candidates who are polling in the 1% or less than 1%. I mean, hey, everybody's crossing their fingers and hoping that, you know, they get that one liner, they get that one question that allows him to stand out and become a, you know, a Donald Trump runout, for example, where he was nowhere in the 2015 polls and then now he's our president. But betting odds, that's probably not going to happen. So set yourself up for a good job in 2020 after the election.
Right. The way I've heard it said is, like, if you get a fat pitch over the plate in a debate and you knock it out of the park, then all of a sudden you're a point of discussion and there's buzz and all of a sudden things can, you know, sort of turn around for you as a candidate, or maybe, you know, it sort of is a moment that can set off momentum in a field quite this diverse or large, I should say. But I want to talk a little bit about the diversity and the size of this field here and just talk directly about the question of how many people are on this debate stage, if we could. And there were a few candidates who were left out, you know, Montana Governor Steve Bullock, Mayor Wayne Messam of Miramar, Florida, Massachusetts, Congressman Seth Moulton, former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. But, you know, the terms of participation here were pretty broad to participate in this debate. There, after all, was a cap of 20 candidates participating in these first round debates. And Sean, I guess, you know, you were talking about how the party might be coming into this sort of fractured. What's your take on whether a large field in the debate stage, is it a good thing or is it just confusing to people?
Oh, I think it's a good thing, actually. I think the more ideas that you get put out there, and if someone comes out of from nowhere in the pack and ends up doing well, so be it. You know, can I find a justification why Eric Swalwell should be in this race? He's a California member of Congress who, I guess, the fact that he grew up in Iowa, he feels he's qualified to run for the race. I'm not sure why he's in there. You've got Oprah Winfrey's friend who's running. You've got the entrepreneur, Mr. Yang, who's running. So, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe they have some role to play here. But it's exciting, and it forces people to stretch their legs. People say, and I absolutely believe this, a presidential race is really the ultimate in Darwinian survival. So you've got to do almost everything right. You've got to raise money well. You've got to appeal to certain votes. You've got to do the math with regards to what different states are doing. You have to be able to win in a caucus state as well as win in a general election primary state. You've got to win in a state like California, which doesn't have winner take all if you win the state. They're a proportional delegate. So it is the ultimate. And if you can survive that, then chances are pretty good that you can actually do a lot of things as president of the United States. And I believe it. I've been involved in many national presidential campaigns, statewide Senate and governor races, and it really does matter. If you can do that well, then you can usually do the job well enough.
Vicky, you've cited the diversity of this field of Democratic presidential candidates as an upside of having such a broad field here. And yet we still see two white men at the top of the polls here, at least if you look at, you know, say the Real Clear Politics polling average. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are still at the top. Now, you do have an Elizabeth Warren in the mix and a Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg as well. But at the end of the day, do we really benefit by having people who are on there? So many people, I think there are a dozen candidates who are polling at an average of a percentage point or less. And does diversity in the party benefit from having such a wide audience of so many people who are polling at so low that, as you were saying before, it's like the chances of them taking fire are relatively low?
You know, Kyle, I'm of two minds here, and I am struggling with this because from the Democratic small d kind of theoretical perspective, the more the merrier, the more voices we have, the stronger it is for our democracy. But on the other hand, too many cooks in the kitchen is a bad thing. So we're going to have, so far we haven't seen the Democratic candidates really come at one another. But I'm not going to hold my breath. I think that's going to happen sooner rather than later. So I don't think this is a good thing for the Democratic Party in and of itself. That is one negative that I see to so many candidates. I also see the Netflix paralysis. You know, when you have so many options in front of you, like you just don't know what to pick. You just keep clicking and clicking and you second guess yourself. And maybe sometimes you don't pick anything and that's it for the night. Or maybe we keep looking at the candidates. We don't know who we really, really want. And we just don't pick anybody, especially getting into the general. So that, I don't know. I see lots of pros, lots and cons. The one thing that I do think will help the Democratic Party is that they did move up their Super Tuesday to becoming a Super Duper Tuesday with the addition of you, California. So hopefully the field will be winnowed by then. The worst thing in the world for the Democratic Party is to go into a June or July without having a clear front runner defined. So I think that the calendar will help moderate some of the problems that can come from such numerical chaos.
Yeah. I hope that term catches fire, super duper primary. That's going to sound very dignified for all the evening news anchors to be saying that term.
It's a technical term.
Very technical term. Sean, I want to, you know, there's a comment on the AirTalk page, and I was hoping to ask you about this. This is from Melanie on the AirTalk page writing, "I disagree with Sean that the Democrats are fragmented because of racial and gender diversity. If anything, they are inclusive because I see myself represented by their identity, but also their values. As a woman of color, I still see the Republican Party as not a great option." The thing about that question, Sean, that I wanted to ask you was that I do hear a lot from Republicans, and I think we talked about it a little earlier, that the thinking is that the Democrats are so wildly, you know, ideologically, you know, diverse and chaotic right now. When I think the you know, discussion about where Democrats should go are probably a little bit closer together on the spectrum than where, for instance, Republicans in the primary were going in 2016. So I guess I'm just curious, you know, like, how do you respond to that Democrats maybe not quite as far apart and are just inclusive to a bunch of different identities, which comes with different problems, but maybe they're not so ideologically far apart?
Well, fragmented doesn't mean fragmented where they can't get along and they don't have overarching goals and objectives that they support from the Democratic Party perspective. Fragmented means that you've got different constituencies within the party that support different candidates. It could be on racial or ethnic lines, could be on different sorts of policy lines. So it's a fragmented political process having that many people, and it's a more of a food fight moving forward. And that's actually not just in this race. It's historically been more so in the Democratic Party than it has been for the Republican Party. Republican parties tend to be pre-Donald Trump. You know, it's the older kind of white guy who's waited his turn in line, and then he generally moves up and then runs for president after the other guy moved out. So as I say, I'm not assigning fragmented, meaning the society's not getting along and people are throwing things at each other. It's just fragmented politically. Let me also raise one other issue, too. The great thing about primaries is the fact that they winnow people down. So when you get to Iowa and you get to New Hampshire, it's a giant funnel and it's a choke point. And most of the candidates who are in the, you know, unnamed category will be smoked. They'll be gone. They'll die at that period. Some of them may stay in the race just to be in the race, but the attention, the money, and everything else will go away. The interesting thing, I disagree a little bit about what the professor is the fact that you've moved the Super Tuesday primary up and you've moved California up. If California were a winner-take-all primary state, I would concur with that. But California is a state, as we mentioned, is proportional. So you need to get at least 15% of the state's vote to qualify for the delegates. But there's, I think, 272 based on congressional districts and 144 delegates that are awarded proportionally on a statewide basis. So you could have, after the California primary, you could have a Biden, a Sanders, a Warren, and a Mayor Pete all in this race, all qualified, and then they actually stay alive longer and you have more fighting that goes on as opposed to solving, I think, what some people wanted to say and have a clearer runner. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Shanti Walsh is a Republican political analyst, and Victoria DeFrancesco Soto is a professor of political science, a lecturer in political science at the University of Texas. We are having our weekly look at politics as we do most Mondays. We're going to come back and talk about one of the choke points Sean just mentioned, which is the California primary, right after a quick news update with Tammy Trujillo. Glad to have you with us on Air Talk here on a Monday morning. I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle. Coming up in about 20 minutes here, we are going to discuss the weekend's big NBA trade that has title talk back on here in Los Angeles for Laker fans, at least. Anthony Davis now comes to join LeBron on the Lakers. We want to hear your thoughts about the deal. You can go right now and weigh in at kpcc.org/airtalk on the Air Talk page. Leave a comment. Let us know if you're excited about this big trade. But right now, we're going to continue our weekly revisiting of the week that was in politics with Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, a lecturer in political science and director of civic engagement at the University of Texas, and Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst and partner at Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco. And I want to stay just for a moment with the Democratic primary field before we get to some of the domestic politics news of this last week. Now, we haven't seen a lot of state-level polls for California in the presidential race. Of course, the primary here is going to be a big deal because, as Vicky says, it's on Super-Duper Tuesday now. But the LA Times and UC Berkeley came out with a poll last week. It had Joe Biden, the front runner, at 22% in California, with Elizabeth Warren surging into second place in California with 18% of the vote, ahead of even Bernie Sanders at 17%. And it all seems to be really bad news for Kamala Harris, who is in fourth place in her home state poll with only 13%, and Pete Buttigieg hot on her heels at 10%. I want to take it to our panelists and start with the Californian on the panel here. Sean T. Walsh, is Kamala Harris a viable candidate without California?
I don't think she is. I just think that if she does not do well in Iowa and she does not do well in New Hampshire, and then you go, maybe she does okay in New Hampshire, and I think she really badly needs South Carolina. And I do think that's, you know, being ethnically diverse, racially diverse, helps her in South Carolina. But if she rolls into California and does not qualify for the proportional delegates at 15%, her campaign is dead in the water.
Yeah. Vicky, your thoughts on this, too. Is the senator viable without California?
So my read on these numbers are they're not great, but they're not terrible. And they're not terrible because the numbers, as the LA Times points out, that she's consistently the second choice. So, you know, ideally, you want to be first. If you're not first, you're last, as Ricky Bobby would say. But in this case, if as the election season goes on and certain people stumble, they trip, say Joe Biden, who's the front runner, is just like, say, Jeb Bush was in 2016, starts to stumble, those folks who were lingering in that second place, those second choices, are able to bubble up. So I think this is not a bad place to be with 500 days until the election and about 250 until the primaries. I think she's in an okay spot.
All right. I want to leave the Democratic presidential primary field for a minute and go to the president that we currently have for a moment after so much talk of the primary. And I want to talk about opposition research.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
Well, from the same Donald Trump who brought you that gem during the 2016 campaign last week, the now president said this.
If foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it.
That is the much-played clip from an ABC News special that the president equated the circumstance that correspondent George Stephanopoulos is to accepting opposition research, a.k.a. legitimate political gamesmanship. Now, to a lot of critics, this response from the president seemed to suggest that President Trump might be willing to accept foreign interference in a future election. And a number of Republicans even counted among the outspoken critics here. Let's start with Vicky. I mean, what did you make of this clip? Was this, you know, throwing open the door to interference, or was this trying to refer to legitimate political gamesmanship?
I was not surprised, Kyle, in hearing this. You know, it wasn't a shocker to me to hear Donald Trump say this. I mean, this is a man who has made it very clear that he will do anything to win. He will cheat. He will do whatever he needs to do. And when I read this headline, it came to mind a couple of months ago, a book came out talking about Trump and how he cheats in golf. It was called Commander and Cheat. Donald Trump is someone who we have seen cheat in his marriages, cheat in business deals, cheat in golf. So why are we surprised that he's saying he's willing to cheat in elections by taking information from foreign governments? So for me, I was completely underwhelmed by this news.
You saw this, though, as not, you know, as definite proof of that he would be willing to accept interference from a foreign government, and not that he was trying to refer to something much more innocuous that happens in campaigns all the time of legitimately obtained information being exchanged legitimately, at least in the sense that it wasn't obtained through a crime like the hack of the DNC or of anything like that. You did see this as opening the door to something that was less legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that I'm not surprised doesn't mean that I don't think it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. It's treasonous in my view. But I think that if you look at the larger pattern of our president's actions, again, as I laid out in other areas of his life, this is not something that we should be surprised about.
Sean, did you see this as throwing open the door to something illegitimate, or was he trying to allude to, you know, legitimate, you know, exchange of information that happens in political campaigns all the time?
I don't think it's legitimate at all. I think it's repulsive that he just did a casting call for intelligence agencies across the world to, hey, put a little bit of time, a little bit of resources, and a little bit of effort into looking at different candidates. And you know, if you get me something good, maybe I'll cast a little bit of favor towards your country and your government. You know, now people do this. The North Koreans actually are clumsy at it, but they engage in kind of political activities. Many countries do that. They do it generally quietly. But doing a casting call and then potentially currying favor with a foreign country by giving intelligence information, I just think it's appalling. It's terrible, terrible, terrible.
Sean T. Walsh is a Republican political consultant, and Vicky DeFrancesco Soto is a professor at the University of Texas. We will be right back after a short break on Air Talk to talk about a little shakeup in the Trump administration of a public face set to depart. This is Air Talk. We're taking a look back at the week that was in politics with Vicky DeFrancesco Soto of the University of Texas and Republican political analyst Sean T. Walsh here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I am Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle. The White House has struggled with staff turnover. Well, more shakeups are coming. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is set to depart as White House press secretary at the end of the month. President Trump announced her departure on Twitter last week. Sean, if you would, rate Sarah Huckabee Sanders' job performance as press secretary.
Well, that's a hard thing to do. And I will tell you, so I worked, as you know, in the press offices for President Reagan and President Bush. And I would, and I've done briefings myself. That is one of the hardest jobs in the world to do. You literally strap on your combat boots generally in a normal administration. Almost every day you go out and you brief the press and you basically get beaten up for an hour to 2 hours going through every policy issue in the world. The second thing that happens generally is that once the news cycle goes forward, most presidents aren't sitting there in their offices watching the press briefing live and sending notes halfway through the session and beating up on you for not being strong enough and defending you and critiquing it. So I would say Sarah Huckabee Sanders had almost an impossible job. I think that being a press secretary to this president is almost an impossible job. And I think there's a reason why she canceled her daily White House briefings, because she was causing more grief and trouble for herself by actually briefing and having the president critique and attack her on her own style. So she canceled the briefings and talked to them behind closed doors just to get information out. And the relationship between the media and President Trump is as bad as it was in kind of pre-Civil War era or Civil War era stuff. So, you know, I don't know the new person coming in, whether they can do any better than Sarah Sanders did, because it's the nature of who Donald Trump is.
Right.
You have two bosses, the media and the public, and then you have the president.
And as many people have pointed out, Vicky, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is competing with Donald Trump's own Twitter account in terms of getting the White House's message out. I'm wondering how you would rate her job performance.
Again, this, Sean noted.
That was a pregnant sigh there.
I think she did as well as she could with what she had given her boss. All personal feelings aside, she did what she had to do. And in terms of the daily press briefings, again, for those of us listening to the show, it was galling. We're used to getting the daily press briefing. It's part of, you know, the political machinations. But at the same time, most folks live their lives not knowing that 94 days have gone by without an official White House press briefing. So, you know, she was able to walk the line. I think she did that. And the other thing is, I'm wondering whether we have come to a generational shift, that maybe those press briefings and maybe that indirect communication that the White House has with the general American public has changed forever. Maybe it's just Donald Trump and it's exceptional to him. Or are we going to be seeing the next president after Donald Trump communicating with the American public more directly via Twitter, social media? So for me, her departure also means a bigger theoretical question about how our chief executive is going to be interacting with the American public. And I think that we are going to be seeing a difference from here on out, even if just slight, in the role of the press secretary, perhaps diminishing for forever after the Trump presidency.
Yeah, I think if we took Donald Trump out of that question, if we took the question of this very polarizing presidency out of the equation, does it matter that there be a sort of daily convening of reporters to do the briefing on a daily or almost daily basis as it has been performed now? I mean, there's certainly this discussion about whether this daily briefing should be revived. And I'd love love to hear both of your thoughts on this. Sean, if we could start with you. I mean, take Donald Trump out of the equation here. Does it matter whether we have – I can't believe I'm a journalist and I'm saying this, but does it matter that we have a daily press briefing in an administration to have the dialogue that as it was previously envisioned and have that going forward?
It absolutely matters. I would say that it is an absolutely critical function for a well-functioning government. I mean, I believe that one of the worst things that's happened to government public policy is Twitter. Government and public policy are very complex issues. They're not simple lines you can use in 38 characters or whatever it actually is. And so a briefing does several things. A, it allows an administration to speak with one voice, and that means every cabinet secretary, every department, and the president, him or herself, number one. Number two, it allows you to get policy ideas out in a clean, crisp, and concise way. And then number three, it lets off a lot of steam. So if something is a crisis situation that's going on, and thank goodness we haven't had really a major crisis since President Trump has been here, having a briefing, having the ability to let off steam in that White House press briefing has enormous positive benefits on a national security perspective. So I think it's critical. If I was going to make a recommendation, when we were in the White House with President Reagan and President Bush, we would do briefings, but what we would do is we would only let sound and camera, radio and TV, get the top 3 minutes of the briefing. Then they had to turn everything off. I would go back to the regular briefings. I would not let people do live TV. I would not let them do live radio. And then I would basically confiscate or say, you can't use your smartphones in here and tweet out in the middle of the briefing to cause trouble. So, I would, because
I think as a journalist to explain my oh boy, I understand the argument against, you know, sort of the instant reaction that so much of Washington is now message tested. On the other hand, there's sort of like a free speech issue in there on some level, and I think that would certainly, you know, be a very controversial proposition, especially to a journalist who wouldn't like, you know, to be told you can't say any. I mean, journalists don't like to be told that anyway, but even under some reasonable restrictions, it seems to sort of like push against that area where I think journalists and I think even some members of the public would be comfortable.
Well, we did it, though. I mean, we didn't let sound and camera on and they weren't wild about it, but they accepted it. And I think just adding the social media, the tweeting and the email is part of that. I think you could go back to that. And the truth of the matter is the journalists get so much more out of those briefings, and the briefings aren't just the press secretary going up there and sparring and spinning. You bring in national security people. You bring in domestic policy people. You really get a full breadth and depth of what's going on in an administration. I think the benefits to journalists far outweigh and they would accept that as opposed to, you know, tweeting something out. So I would do it.
Yeah. Vicky, your quick thoughts on that idea about whether or not, I mean, obviously we have this attachment to the institution, but in maybe 30 or 45 seconds here, if you can tell me whether you think that this is an institution worth preserving.
I think it's an institution worth preserving, but keeping in mind modern technology. So I'm actually disagreeing here quite vehemently with Sean in terms of saying, well, we've got to take their phones away and they can't tweet and they can't do this. I've tried taking the phones and the computers away from my students and it did not work. We are in a changed world and we have to accept that media is produced and consumed differently. And same goes for a White House briefing. So we haven't had it in a while. If it comes back, great. But we're also going to have to allow to the changes that have happened in our communications over the last decade or two.
Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, otherwise known as Vicky, and I'm sorry I keep saying Victoria, though you've corrected me before, a lecturer in political science and director of civic engagement at the University of Texas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst and partner at Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco, a former advisor to California Governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, former White House staffer for Presidents Reagan and H.W. Bush. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And coming up on Air Talk, we are going to delve into the big trade that has everyone around the NBA talking this week. LeBron and Anthony Davis are finally united in purple and gold. We want to hear your thoughts on the trade at 866-893-KPCC. Again, that's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page. We will be back after a check of the news here at the top of the hour to discuss this big trade on AirTalk. Good morning. Glad to have you with us on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I am Kyle Stokes. I am in Larry Mantle's chair for this week. I'm so glad to be here. I'm so glad you're going to have me here. And I'm excited about having this conversation with you about all of the issues that we're going to discuss this week. And this hour, we're going to hear a very interesting conversation about the protests that are going on in Hong Kong right now. Massive pro-democracy protests pushing back against pro-Beijing legislation. But before we get to that, we have to get to this weekend's big story here in LA. And it's a sports story, the Lakers and the trade being talked about all around the NBA this morning. First, there was LeBron. Now there is LeBrow. I'm sorry, I had to do that pun. The Lakers announced plans to trade for New Orleans Pelicans big man Anthony Davis, one of the league's best players and by reputation, one of the world's best unibrows, hence his nickname, The Brow, sometime nickname, I should say. He might have shaved it, actually. The Lakers had to give up a lot of young talent in the trade. Lonzo Ball, Josh Hart, Brandon Ingram, along with this year's fourth overall selection in the NBA draft. But LeBron James now has the superstar sidekick he's wanted. And after missing the playoffs for six straight seasons, the Lakers are contenders again and perhaps the top team in the West, if not the league overall. This is a win today move, so I want to hear from you about it. How are you feeling about the move? Are the days of Laker greatness back? Or did the Lakers give up too much in this trade, jeopardizing their own future? We are going to take your calls and reactions all this hour at 866-893-KPCC. Maybe you're a Laker fan who in 6 years have missed playoffs. Maybe you let your season ticket subscription expire. We want to hear from you. Or you may be regretting that decision now, trying to get back in on the action. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. With me to discuss it is A. Martinez, our own co-host of Take Two right here on KPCC, former longtime pre- and post-game show host for the Lakers. Thanks for being with us, A.
And as a man, Kyle, who threads his eyebrows twice a week, I've always been looking to see when Anthony Davis would actually make the move and make it two eyebrows. So far, he hasn't done it yet. Maybe he's an L.A. guy now. Maybe he's going to just join all the rest of
He'll start doing hot yoga,
the
eating
Metro
avocados.
Sexuals here that, that wax and thread.
And all of that stuff. You have impeccable eyebrows, yes, Martinez, I do have to say. So I'm wondering if you can set up the backstory here. The Lakers last offseason, of course, brought in LeBron James, and the idea was this was part one of a two-year rebuild here?
Yeah, and that was the whole thing, is to eventually build the team up to where it would be a championship contender that LeBron could direct, could be the centerpiece of. They tried to force a deal with the Pelicans at the trade deadline of this past season. Anthony Davis's agent behind the scenes tried to engineer it. The Lakers were not able to pull it off, and we still really don't know exactly what was the reason. And I think a lot of it had to do with the Pelicans and their front office was still in a bit of a transition stage, so they didn't want to make any deal until they heard all the possible deals. But over the weekend, they were able to, at least every sports news site is reporting, that eventually the trade will go down, that Anthony Davis, arguably one of the top five players in the NBA, a power forward who averages nearly 30 points a game and 11 rebounds per game, will be coming to the Lakers in July for the upcoming season to pair up with LeBron James. They had to give up, Kyle, a lot of players to do it, but you know, they're young players who haven't established themselves, so the Lakers are saying, well, we've got a bona fide superstar in trading for a bunch of guys who really haven't proved anything yet. So that for them, that was a price that they're willing to pay.
Give up a lot of young talent as well as every draft pick, basically, until the end of time as well. Well, we should talk about the terms of this deal, which we understand is not yet final, with the Lakers beat reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Tanya Ganguly is with us. Thanks for being with us, Tanya.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, can you tell us about the terms of this deal? Our understanding is that it's not technically finalized, but the deal is essentially done, right?
Yeah, they've agreed to it. What's not final is when exactly the deal will be executed. And that has really big salary cap implications for the Lakers, because if they're able to move it back, if they're able to get the Pelicans to agree to wait until 30 days after the draft to do this trade, then they'll be able to have space for another max contract, and that'll be really big for them. But it doesn't seem like the Pelicans are going to be willing to do that, especially because that the fourth overall pick that they sent over is a big part of this trade and a big part of what the Pelicans are trying to use to, they're trying to flip that into a player. So it doesn't seem like they're going to do that. But as far as the terms, I mean, they're giving up three first round draft picks. Another year, they have the right to swap, and between 2024 and 2025, the Pelicans have the right to choose which of those picks they want.
Right.
It's a big deal. I mean, they also gave up three young players, two of whom were second overall picks in the draft recently. So they're giving up a lot, but it's for a really tremendous player who's still very much in the prime of his career.
Yeah. A. Martinez here in the studio with me also brought up sort of the backstory of how this deal came together came together in the end, but in February, it looked like it was causing problems for just about everybody involved, for executives on both the Lakers side and the Pelicans side. Can you talk us through that backstory here? Because I think that backstory of how the deal didn't get done back in January, February was just wild.
So in late January, Anthony Davis asked, his agent, Rich Paul, asked Del Demps, who was the general manager of the New Orleans Pelicans, to trade Anthony Davis. But he told him that he didn't want to be with the franchise long term, that he would walk away in free agency in 2020, and that it would be better for everybody if he just traded him. After he made that request, it became public a few days later, and then once that happened, the Lakers really dove into trying to do this. They knew that they were one of the destinations that Anthony Davis was very interested in. And, you know, they threw everything at it. But the problem was Del Demps was not willing to work with Rob Pelinka, who's the Lakers' general manager. He would only take calls from Magic Johnson, who at the time was their top basketball.
Oh, man.
And even though he was taking calls from Magic Johnson, he really wasn't planning to trade Davis. That wasn't going to be something that happened, and so we kind of allowed the Lakers to keep making offers and keep making offers, and then a lot of those offers became public, and it really messed with the chemistry on the team because a lot of the young players had never been through that before. They'd never heard their name being brought up in trades. They all thought, I mean, Lonzo Ball was just a year and a half removed from being called the face of the franchise at his introductory press conference. So, you know, it was tough for all the players, and it was also tough for them because they knew that LeBron was on the record saying he would love to play with Anthony Davis. And so that also damaged chemistry a little bit. And I don't think the Lakers really ever recovered from it. Del Demps got fired. And part of the reason why Magic Johnson stepped down, obviously, and part of the reason why this worked this time around was that David Griffin, who's now the top basketball executive in New Orleans, was much more willing to work with the Lakers than Del Demps had been.
Yeah. Tanya Ganguly, the Lakers beat reporter for the LA Times, kind of walking us through the Anthony Davis trade here that brings him to the Lakers, joins him with LeBron James, and now turns the Lakers into immediate title favorites. We want to hear your thoughts on this deal. Give us a call, 866-893-KPCC. Again, that's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page. Is this a good deal for the Lakers? Are we talking about a title now, or are we talking about mortgaging the team's future? I want to take a few of those calls. Also mention that you can leave your comment on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Let's start with Ben in West L.A.
Hi, I was against the AD trade. I was also against signing LeBron. I would have preferred them build their young core and sign two younger max free agents. But given the dumpster fire that is the Lakers ownership and front office, this is probably their best available move. But they needed to do this, structure it in a way, as you guys were talking about, where they could sign another max free agent, and they seem to actually have botched that. So now here we are, depending on Laker exceptionalism to make up for Laker incompetence. And I think it's time to bring back Jerry Buss, Weekend at Bernie's style.
How does this affect you? I mean, are you a Laker fan, Ben? Years old.
I grew up in L.A. I grew up with Magic and Kareem, and I grew up with good ownership, where they made smart strategic decisions to plan for the present and the future. And they were completely set up to do that, where they structured their cap in a way where they could sign two max free agents over 2 years and then keep their whole young core so they could,
right,
for now and build for the future. They've blown that up. I understand why they did it at this point, but it wouldn't, given how much they gave up, and Tanya Ganguly, your beat reporter, was laying out three first-round picks, that they could have easily gotten the Pelicans to agree to let them sign a third max free agent. It just would have required delaying the signing of the number four pick in the draft to the end of the month. And the fact that they couldn't pull that off is just exhibit A for their utter incompetence. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, on the draft, well, I mean, I think a lot of Laker fans have PTSD from the Steve Nash trade, where we spent the last decade rooting against our own team so they wouldn't lose their picks.
Yeah, Tanya, I wonder if we can unpack some of that here. I mean, we've got these first-round draft picks that are going away in this deal, and you know, I think it seems to me like if this is a win today move, you know, quote unquote, that if you're trading away first-round draft picks, you're betting that this team is going to win, and then those first-round draft picks aren't going to be worth much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a boom or bust move for the Lakers, because if it works out, they're not going to miss those draft picks. The Pelicans are not going to want to swap with them if this works out and they're at the bottom of the draft every year. So that can happen, but also, the Steve Nash, Dwight Howard trade, that was the last time the Lakers gave up this much. And, I mean, I started covering the team in 2016. They were still paying for it. That trade was in 2012. They hung on to the picks 3 years in a row because it got into the top three, and they were so lucky to do that. But you did wind up with a situation where they were just paying for it and paying for it and paying for it until they never really got what they wanted out of that trade. They never got a championship out of having Steve Nash and Dwight Howard there.
And Ben, thanks so much for your call. I wonder if you could weigh in here. I mean, mm-hmm. Anthony Davis is 26. I mean, the sort of flip side to this about developing the young core is that he's a relatively young player, arguably in his prime. No, I'm not the basketball guy.
Yes, he absolutely is. And the thing about it, too, is when they brought in LeBron James, who is right now 34, he's going to be 35 at the end of this year, they've essentially pushed in all their chips to the length of his contract. They can't wait for young players to develop because LeBron James isn't getting any younger. And although he probably is going to age very gracefully because he keeps himself in tremendous shape and he's very, very smart, he'll adjust his style as he gets older. They have a 4-year window with arguably the greatest player of all time in LeBron James. You can't wait for young players to make their mistakes and figure it out because you don't have the time to do it. And the other part about this, Kyle, is that for better or worse, LA is a star-driven town. You hone your act somewhere else and then you come to LA when you're ready. And that's what Laker fans have not had enough of over the last 6 years of missing the playoffs, is that star. They have LeBron, and now they have two stars, and maybe they can add a third. But that's the whole point of being in LA, is that you love watching those stars perform in front of you.
We're talking about that big blockbuster trade that was pulled off this weekend for Anthony Davis, the superstar from the New Orleans Pelicans, who now joins the Los Angeles Lakers, and LeBron James in a quest to bring a title back to LA and a playoff appearance back to LA as well. We are taking your calls and we want to hear your thoughts. Has this changed the Lakers for the better or for the worse? Give us a call, 866-893-KPC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page at kpcc.org/airtalks. Your calls and comments coming up right after a quick break. Keeping things rolling here on AirTalk, I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle, talking about the blockbuster trade for Anthony Davis, bringing him into a Laker uniform alongside LeBron James, and now talking with you about how this affects the chances for the Lakers to bring a title back to the city of LA. We are taking your calls and comments at the AirTalk page, kpcc.org/airtalk, or at 866-893-KPCC. We've got a call and a question, actually, from the city of Orange and Mohammed. Mohammed, you're on AirTalk.
Hello. My question is, have trading away Lonzo Ball and not having a point guard right now for the Lakers, how does that affect their further free agency pursuits, having that vacant spot in their lineup?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Mohammed. Let's bring into the conversation here A. Martinez, a host for us here at KPCC and also a former longtime pre- and post-game show host for Lakers broadcasts. I mean, how does that affect their free agency pursuits having Lonzo Ball gone now?
Well, if they get no one else, LeBron James could be the de facto point guard if he had to be. He's a person that can really handle the ball very well. He's very intelligent. He knows how to run an offense. But if they can somehow make the money work, there are some big names that are going to be out there in different kinds of ways. Kyrie Irving, who is an all-star with the Boston Celtics. He's been rumored to want to go to Brooklyn or somewhere else and leave the Boston Celtics. He could be a possibility. Kemba Walker is another all-star caliber player who's a point guard. On this issue, Kyle, they won't have to spend a ton for a superstar. They can even go get a player that they had before, D'Angelo Russell, who played for the Brooklyn Nets, who left amid a bit of a scandal with the Lakers, but he could come back. All they need is a somewhat intelligent, reasonable body in that spot. LeBron and Anthony Davis handle the rest.
Yeah, Tanya Ganguly, the LA Times Lakers beat reporter. How do you think that this affects their free agency pursuits, given that the Lakers don't have a natural point guard by trading Lonzo Ball away?
Well, not only do they not have a natural point guard, they only have one guard on the roster right now who has a guaranteed contract for next year, and it's Isaac Bonga, their second round pick last year. So not getting anyone is not an option for them. I think that Kemba Walker and Kyrie Irving are two guys would be great for the Lakers. I don't know if they're going to be able to make the money work for that. Maybe they will. Maybe those are guys that will want to join this team and take a little bit of a pay cut to do that. Who knows what happens with them. But I do agree that this is an opportunity for Rob Pelinka, the Lakers general manager, to build a team and build a team the right way that gives them all the pieces they need. LeBron James is going to have a lot of the ball handling responsibilities. So you don't need a guy you don't need a ball dominant point guard. But you know, they're going to have to make smart decisions, which they did not do last year when they built their team. They surrounded LeBron with other ball handlers and didn't really get the shooting that they needed, and it didn't work. So we're going to get a really interesting look at how Pelinka does with building a team now.
Jack in Zurich writes on the Air Talk page, the biggest thing the Lakers did was get rid of the Ball kid and his 250 pounds of mouthy baggage that is his dad.
By the way, his father has put a curse on the Lakers. They will never win a championship now that they shipped his son away to New Orleans. That's what he said.
There was an interesting anecdote in the SI story that preceded this trade, actually, but asking the question, does LeBron and his agent Rich Paul run the Lakers now? And a Lakers spokesperson responded, quote, "That's not true," adding with exasperated chuckle, "Everyone knows that LeVar Ball runs the team." Which I thought was a great anecdote. Let's go to Sam in Covina. Sam, you are on Air Talk.
Yes, I think the Lakers made a great move. It's all about winning today. I think bringing this gentleman from the Pelicans took about 5 years off of LeBron James' life. It brought new youth. And winning championships are now back in Los Angeles.
Sam, how big would you rate your Laker fandom?
On a scale of 1 to 10, a 15. GPA, my GPA in college was low because of Magic, James Worthy.
That's beautiful.
I wish I'd have used that excuse when I was in high school with my mom. Magic. It's Magic Johnson. Yeah. I'm paying too much attention to them.
This is only going to happen once in my life. Sam, thank you so much for your call. Michael in Glendale, let's go to you. You are on Air Talk.
Yes. Hi. How are you guys?
Great. What's your comment?
My comment is basically, as we've seen in the past, I think, first of all, the move is great. If we've seen from the past history, in the 80s, you had Magic. You had Magic as a guard and a center, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, dominating the 80s. And of course, with Kobe and Shaq in the early 2000s, they dominated the Western Conference Finals and moved to the finals to win a championship. So having LeBron with Anthony Davis is, for Laker fans, no worries. The title is back in LA. You still got a few young guys. You still have Kuzma. You still have Rajon Rondo, who can be a backup to Kyrie. Hopefully Kyrie can make his way through. If they possibly get Jimmy Butler, it's a wrap. He's a great defender. And pretty soon the Lakers are going to be celebrating their parade on Figueroa Street. So this is it. It's a wrap.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate you calling into Air Talk. I want to throw one last question around to our panel here. And that's the sort of, you know, question that was raised in that SI cover story about the influence that these big star players have on the league now. The comment that LeVar Ball runs the team with exasperation, but that is bouncing off the accusation that LeBron and his agent are now really actually stacking the roster for the Lakers, and that the Lakers general manager and front office are just middlemen for all of this, and what that says about the league. A. Martinez, what does that say about the league?
Well, it says that players have more power than they ever have had, and especially in the NBA. When David Falk was the big agent in the 80s, and Michael Jordan was one of his biggest clients, I think it'd be naive to think that whenever there was a move made, that Michael Jordan or David Falk weren't somehow asked about it, consulted, whether it was publicly or privately. And that's what's going on now. LeBron James has the stature where you should run things by him and his agent when it comes to these big business moves. So, yeah, that's exactly what it shows, is that the NBA players have a ton of power and they've earned it by now.
Tanya, I want to throw that question as well to you, Lakers beat reporter for the LA Times, Tanya Ganguly. What does it say now that we've got, you know, two highly influential people in LeBron James and his agent, you know, arguably, you know, debatably stacking the roster for the team?
Well, I mean, I think it's exactly what A said, that players have a lot of power, and I think it's also rightfully so. I don't understand. You know, you hear a lot of this, like, oh, the Lakers are trying to appease LeBron. Well, of course they are, and they should be, because he is the first superstar that came to them after they whiffed and whiffed and whiffed in free agency. And I always thought that their best shot at getting a free agent this summer was going to be LeBron recruiting that guy, because I think his connection to whoever comes in is going to be way more important than whatever the front office can tell them.
Tanya Ganguly is the Lakers beat reporter for the Los Angeles Times, here to discuss the blockbuster trade that brings in Anthony Davis, a superstar big man from the New Orleans Pelicans, here to the Los Angeles Lakers to join LeBron in a quest to bring a title back to L.A. Tanya, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
And A. Martinez, a host of Take Two, which you can hear this afternoon at 2 right here on 89.3 KPCC in a vault, a font of all things knowledge, Laker knowledge. Thank you so much for joining us, A.
Thanks, Al.
We'll be back in just a minute here on Air Talk with a discussion about Hong Kong. You're listening to 89.3 KPCC, and it's 11:30. There are 7 million residents of the territory of Hong Kong, and for the second weekend running, perhaps almost 2 million of them attended massive peaceful protests in the semi-autonomous city. Directly at issue, a piece of legislation backed by the city's chief executive, Carrie Lam, whose name was being chanted there by the tape that you just heard from the streets of Hong Kong, that would allow for foreign nationals arrested in Hong Kong to be sent for trial to places with which the city doesn't currently have extradition agreements, which would include mainland China. This legislation is backed by Beijing. The chief executive is picked by Beijing. Well, with these giant protests, one last Sunday, one this weekend, and some in between, perhaps as many as a quarter of Hong Kong residents have now come out to the streets to protest this legislation. There have been some clashes with police. A protester has died. All of it an indication of the gravity of the question that they are collectively raising. Can Hong Kong maintain some independence from the control of mainland China? Here with me to discuss these protests is Victoria Tinbor Hui, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, specializing in Hong Kong politics, and she herself is originally from Hong Kong. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kyle.
Can you lay out some context here for us? Like, how does Hong Kong's government work? In what ways is Hong Kong dependent or tied to mainland China? And in what ways is it independent of China?
So, technically speaking, the government should be independent of China. So, should enjoy autonomy under the foreign affairs and military affairs. Then everything should just be done with a high degree of autonomy. The problem is that, effectively, what you said, the chief executive, who really enjoys a lot of prerogatives, is not really
accountable to the people of Hong Kong, but handpicked by Beijing. So then what people call the Western District, because it is Beijing's liaison office located in Western District, has been actually giving a lot of instructions to how the chief executive should govern Hong Kong. So that's really the big problem.
Yeah, there was, I understand, and I'm not a huge knower of all things Hong Kong history, but my understanding is that there was an agreement to transfer Hong Kong away from British control that contained a promise of universal suffrage, of allowing all adult residents and citizens to vote in direct elections, essentially. But I guess the question I have, given these protests, is how much of Hong Kong's government is directly elected by its residents?
Very little. So the chief executive is elected by a very small 1,200 people election committee, and the legislative council, it has 70 seats. Half of them are returned by functional constituencies, and most of those are corporate votes of, a dozen votes. And then 35 of those seats are returned by geographical constituencies. The problem is that a lot of the pro-Beijing, pro-establishment candidates, they have a lot of money and resources. So the Democratic camp often basically cannot really have any say in the legislative council. They always vote it down. This is why people take their voices to the street.
Yeah. And you point out, this sort of all has a direct connection back to these protests that put so many people on the streets this weekend. But I think just another question for context's sake here, my understanding of the breakdown of this legislative council, the legislative body, is that it is something like 2/3 pro-Beijing. Is that right?
Yes.
Why is that the case?
So they always have enough votes to pass whatever the chief executive wants. It's just the case because, as you said earlier, that in 1984, London and Beijing agreed to the Sino-British Joint Declaration, in which Hong Kong people promised a high degree of autonomy, Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong under a one country, two systems model. And so people expected that, well, we are going to have democracy, we can rule Hong Kong. Except that the basic law, Hong Kong's mini constitution, which was released in 1990, then provides for very specific steps of how Hong Kong could get to the genuine election. And a lot of the composition of the legislative council and the chief executive is very clearly laid out until 2007-2008. And then when the time was getting close, Beijing issue a decision. Oh, we don't want to do that. We're not ready. We have to wait for another 10 years. And the umbrella movement broke out because just when we were thinking that, 2017 is coming around, this is time, it's our chance.
Right.
And Beijing issue another decision that can be one person, one vote, but we decide who the candidates can be, two or three of them, screened by Beijing.
Yeah, so just to sort of summarize the context that we've been going through here to all these protests, it's that for the past, two decades now or more, there's been this sort of push and pull about how much direct control should the people of Hong Kong have over their own government. There has been, you mentioned the umbrella movement, which is, a push for more direct democracy, the ability to pick the people who run to be the chief executive of the island. But the poll is that Beijing says that the overall leader of this territory should be basically handpicked by Beijing, and that the people of Hong Kong are not ready for direct democracy. I'm summarizing that adequately?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Well, hold that thought, Professor Victoria Tinbor Wei from the University of Notre Dame. We're going to come back in a few minutes and pick up the discussion, a hugely important protest going on in Hong Kong with as many as 2 million people taking to the streets over the weekend to express their dissatisfaction with legislation that would make the territory more dependent on Beijing. But we are going to first take a quick break here on Air Talk with a live news update with Tammy Trujillo. Two Sundays ago, more than a million people marched in Hong Kong to demonstrate against proposed legislation that critics would say made Hong Kong a little bit more closely tied to the government in mainland China, from which Hong Kong is supposed to be independent. This last weekend, this Sunday, more than or almost 2 million people came out to attend even bigger, massive, peaceful protests in the city of Hong Kong. And we are here to discuss those protests with Victoria Tinbor Wei, an associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. And before we were we had to take that quick news break there. We were discussing the push and pull between, the sort of idea of more democracy, more direct democracy in Hong Kong versus the amount of control that should be exercised by Beijing over Hong Kong's internal affairs. In that context, we have this legislation come up that would allow Hong Kong's chief executive to decide on a case-by-case basis whether to extradite a foreign national accused of a crime to places that Hong Kong may not even have an extradition agreement with. Professor Tinbor Wei, talk us through what was that legislation meant to do? Why was it proposed? What problem was it meant to solve? And why is it so controversial?
Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to clarify that the Sino-British Joint Declaration promises Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy, Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong, but not independence. So just want to emphasize that.
Sure.
And then, but of course, it also means that Hong Kong government should have the independence to run its own business, so far as it is not about foreign affairs or military issues. And so what happened to the extradition bill is that this is more or less the last straw in a long series of efforts to erode Hong Kong's freedom, to erase the firewall between the two systems, the mainland system and the Hong Kong system. Hong Kong has several pillars, important pillars, that we inherited from the pre-1997 era: freedom of expression, an independent judiciary, an independent bureaucracy that really takes care of the entire territory's interests rather than serving just as loyal followers of the governor. And free press. Over the years, Beijing has been controlling every single pillar except the last one that they haven't really made enough inroad into, is the independent judiciary. So by sending Hong Kong people in Hong Kong back to mainland China, which means that this last firewall, this last pillar of freedom, is going to be gone too. So a lot of people, during the previous Sunday's march, not the yesterday, many of them did not believe that their people power could really change the bill. But they were also fearful that this would really be the last time that they could legally protest. And many people fear that the bill is targeted not just some genuine from Hong Kong, they in hiding through the Xi Jinping's very massive campaign against corruption, but also a lot of dissidents and people who continue to commemorate the June 4th vigil in Hong Kong.
Yeah. Victoria Tinbor Wei is a Hong Kong specialist from the University of Notre Dame. With us also is Gabriel Law, who's a spokesperson for the Hong Kong Forum Los Angeles, a nonprofit that promotes democratic development in Hong Kong and in China and is originally from Hong Kong. This weekend, there was a 3-day hunger strike that he was one of the organizers of in Monterey Park that was held in support of the Hong Kong protests. Gabriel Law, thank you so much for being with us on Air Talk.
Good morning.
I'm wondering, just first of all, your general thoughts. I mean, just to see those pictures that we saw on the news of streets chock full of people of so many different ages in support of these, quote unquote, pro-democracy protests.
Yes, I think Hong Kong people did a really great demonstration to how protests should be done to the world. There were also images about people cleaning up afterwards of the 8 or 9 hours of protests. None of the properties were damaged. Everyone helps out everyone almost. Zero violence. No one's got hurt until we get to the police. So overall, just a really, really great feeling. And I think within a week, to have 1 million and then 2 million people talk to the streets was probably unheard of ever in human history. We actually did a check to see you know, not to try to get bragging rights or anything, but we find that we are probably number two in world record in terms of mobilizing number of people to take to the streets.
Yeah. And as we were talking about, Mr. Law, with the professor Victoria Tinbor-Way, the sort of the importance of this legislation, which I think we should probably say at this juncture, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, apologized on Sunday, delaying the controversial extradition legislation. The protesters didn't see the apology as sincere. They want Lam to resign, the legislation to be shelved for good. I guess I'm curious to know what you see the importance of this legislation as being. As we were discussing with the professor, it's this big pillar of the Hong Kong democratic promise. On the other hand, you know, it's extradition legislation. It seems really technical to someone coming at it from the outside. And I'm wondering if you can help us understand the importance of it to you.
I believe that as Americans, we should have more worry about this particular measure. In essence, if you are an American businessman, not even actually arriving at Hong Kong to travel, or even if you're at the airport just for a transit purpose in Hong Kong, if your enemy in China wants to drum up some charges against you, they can ask the Hong Kong police to arrest you.
And of course, Hong Kong, a major international business hub.
Exactly. So it puzzles everyone what's the urgency to pass this amendment. Hong Kong has consistently been ranked as one of the safest cities in the world. There's no major crime one way or the other that has happened in the past 20 years or so. So why do we have no consultation? Why do we, after 1 million people take to the streets, the government just said that in essence, they would just try to do a better job in communicating the amendment bill to the people. This is absolutely needless. It does not need to happen.
Yeah.
Probably triggered so many people to take to the streets.
Well, let me ask the professor about that, Victoria Tinbor-Way. There were arguments made that there were legitimate policy wrinkles here that the legislation was meant to smooth out. For example, recently a Hong Kong native was suspected of killing his pregnant girlfriend while the two were on vacation in Taiwan. But Hong Kong had no extradition agreement with Taiwan, so they couldn't send this suspected killer off for trial. This case has been cited as a reason for passing changes to these extradition laws. But Professor, I'm wondering, is that legitimate or was that just pretext for action here?
It is definitely a pretext because Taiwan, actually, they said that we tried to approach the Hong Kong side many, many times, that there are many different ways to settle this. Except that the Hong Kong government has been saying, oh, we have to really get this bill passed through before we can even then talk about how exactly we should make our arrangements. And then the Taiwan government has also been saying that the bill is going to treat Taiwan as just a province of China, and this is something they would never accept. So there's really no particular urgency because this guy is likely to be released, and then we have nothing to do to actually put him to justice. It's just an excuse. And also the pro-democracy legislators have been offering all kinds of amendments and revisions that could handle the case. But Carrie Lam rejected every single proposal.
Professor Victoria Tinbor-Way of the University of Notre Dame and Gabriel Law, a spokesperson for Hong Kong Forum Los Angeles, here with us to discuss massive protests on the streets of Hong Kong. We will be back in 1 minute to discuss those protests even further. This is Air Talk. Almost 2 million people in the city of Hong Kong, semi-autonomous from mainland China, dependent on it in some ways, but independent of mainland China in others. Huge pro-democracy protests, all targeted against a piece of extradition legislation that would have more closely tied Hong Kong to mainland China, legislation that now has been delayed in the wake of these protests. And we're discussing this legislation with Gabriel Law, spokesperson for Hong Kong Forum Los Angeles, a nonprofit that promotes democratic development in Hong Kong and China. Mr. Law, we've seen before, our other guest, Professor Victoria Tinbor-Wei, mentions in 2014, we saw hundreds of thousands of protesters that took to the streets to push for more direct democracy. This was called the Umbrella Movement. And my understanding is that they didn't get much of what they wanted. They didn't get the direct elections that they had been hoping for. They didn't get more independence from Beijing's handpicked leader, the person who's putting forward this legislation. I'm wondering if this time feels any different, and if so, how?
I think it felt very different, not just by the sheer amount of people who went on the street, but also I think within the more progressive side of things, there seems to be signs of more unity. In the past, there were the marches, and then there were the people staying on the streets to occupy the roads and have conflict with the police.
This was back in 2014, Yes.
Right. And these times, similar things happen, but both sides are showing restraint to not accuse each other. In the past, there were, you guys are trying to incite riot, and that's not right. And then the other side would go, well, you guys just marched and didn't do anything afterwards, and nothing would get changed that way. But this time around, it seems that both sides know that there is a role for everybody. And if we can just work together on this, if you want to march, march. If you want to be a little bit more proactive in confronting the authority, go ahead and do it. So that seems to be one big changes. And may I also mention that, unfortunately, there was also a death.
Yes.
That happened on Saturday. So that also kind of bring an extra layer of emotion into the whole movement as well.
And there were candlelight vigils to mark the death of this 35-year-old who fell to his death while he was hanging a protest banner. Professor Tinbor-Wei, I want to bring you in here on this question about how this might differ from the Umbrella Movement, which we saw 5 years ago in Hong Kong. Similarly, massive protests with hundreds of thousands of people. But I've seen it said, 2014 was around the time of the Occupy movement here in the United States, which would probably be the closest analog, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, to what we saw. But, in the same way that the Occupy movement dragged on, and we saw the message of Occupy sort of grating on American audiences, people sort of retreated into their respective camps. It became divisive over time. I've seen that said about the Umbrella movement as well. Is there the danger of this same kind of grating and sort of erosion of support for that movement in the same way that we've sort of seen the Occupy movement fade into the background and eventually the message in the moment kind of lost its potency?
Yeah, you're quite right. And I also agree with Gabriel's arguments that things actually met better this time. So one thing I want to say is that the size of the Hong Kong's protests are largest in the world in terms of per capita, because Hong Kong's population is only 7 million.
Right.
But otherwise, there were probably way more people protesting in China in 1989, because protests happened all across, not just in Beijing. And also during the Arab uprisings in 2011 as well. But as for what is exactly is the most important difference between the Umbrella Movement of 2014 and today, one big difference.
Professor Victoria Tinbor-Wei is on Skype joining us here, and it sounds like we've lost her Skype connection here. But I want to turn to Gabriel Law, who's a spokesperson for the Hong Kong Forum Los Angeles. One of the things that we've heard is that the legislation that sparked these protests is now delayed. It would, what protesters have asked for is that the legislation be, thrown out altogether, and that the executive of the territory, Carrie Lam, stepped down. Now, Carrie Lam was picked by Beijing. If she steps down, would they not select another pro-Beijing leader to just follow right after her and continue on with the same agenda?
That's almost a certainty, except that when this new person comes into power, it may take some time for he or she to, form her own group of followers and so on, and plan for her legislative agenda. So maybe we will have a little bit of a breathing room, and with that, there may, more may change.
Right.
So it is definitely not an end game per se. We all understand that most likely somehow this may still happen, but we won't just sit at home and do nothing and see this pass.
Gabriel, you were one of the organizers of a three-day hunger strike over this weekend here in Monterey Park over the weekend, held in support of the Hong Kong protests. I wonder if you can tell me about that. What was that like? I understand that you were camped out at Barnes Memorial Park in Monterey Park. What kind of did people who come by understand what you were protesting? Are there connections that were made with people to spread the message more broadly? Or was it more important that there be this act of solidarity, not necessarily that you get the message out within this community?
I think it was definitely to be able to strike up conversations with people who may not know the specifics of why this amendment bill is so dangerous. We were able to have deep discussion with many, many Chinese Americans in the community on the issue. So that was definitely very worthwhile to do. We actually changed from 3 days to 2 days, knowing that 2 million people took to the streets. So we end the hunger strike a little bit early and ended with a rally with about 300 people or so last night. So it was more important to for us to reach out to the community and to have an exchange on opinion on how we should move on next.
Right.
Than just to, adhere to a strict schedule.
Mr. Law, we've only got about a minute left, but I want to ask you in just, 45 seconds or so, did you have any exchange with Chinese Americans who are of the pro-Beijing mindset, who might be suspicious of what the Hong Kongers are doing here?
Maybe not at the rally, but on at a personal level, many of forum members have friends and family holding opposite views. And we know that it is a long, it is a long game. We need to educate them bits by bits, and time seems to be on our side.
Gabriel Law is a spokesperson for Hong Kong Forum Los Angeles, organized a hunger strike this weekend in support of massive democracy protests in Hong Kong. Mr. Law, thank you for joining us here on Air Talk.
Thank you.
And Victoria Tinbor Wei, a professor of political science, associate professor at the University of Notre Dame, specializing in Hong Kong politics. Thank you so much for joining us, professor, as well.
Thank you.
Imagine if something like a million Angelenos took to the streets. That's about a quarter of the city's population. That's what happened in Hong Kong over the weekend, all to support efforts to kill legislation that was seen as making the semi-autonomous island territory more dependent and closer tied to Beijing. We have been discussing it all morning here on Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes, in for Larry Mantle all this week. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you right back here tomorrow.